create time for my dreams. Sekou Andrews. Sekou Andrews is a world-famous poet who, in true artist fashion, wanted to keep it simple. People do not like to change. People try to hold on to their past and who they are. So if you want to change, you must want that immensely more than you want to stay the same. After all, a caterpillar must first forfeit being who he is to become a butterfly. This concludes the interview portion of the Why section. Next is Tim's thoughts on whys. Tim on life-changing questions. Tim answers a few questions which helped him improve his life. Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it is time to pause and reflect. Mark Twain. Is reality real? The truth is, when you analyze what most people consider to be impossible, you find out that it is possible. It is merely something difficult to achieve. This is a relevant distinction to make. People place many self-imposed limits on themselves because they perceive something to be impossible or completely out of their grasp and therefore impossible to them. You want to realize the limitations are holding you back. Once you give yourself the freedom to achieve what you are truly capable of, you may be surprised how far you go. What if you try something different or even in complete opposition with the norm? This is what Tim asked himself earlier in his career when he decided to stop making sales calls during normal business hours like everyone else and instead only make calls before 8:30 a.m. and after 6 p.m. This proved to be significantly more effective, and all it took was the willingness to try something different. What are you not price sensitive to? When Tim was younger, he was spending a ridiculously large amount of money on mental, physical, and health supplements, despite only making about $3,000 per month. When he realized how much he was spending on this, he looked for a business opportunity, and that is how Brain Quicken was started. If there is a specific category you spend a lot of money in, you probably know that category very well and likely have a solid amount of knowledge about it, and if you like it enough to spend large amounts of money, then that means there are other people who also are willing to spend large amounts of money on it. Look for a business in which you can both earn good money and be passionate about your work. If you were only allowed to work 2 hours per week, what would you spend that time doing in relation to your business? The purpose of this question is obvious. It will shed light on your number one priority, and that is where you want to spend most of your time. Hire someone and delegate out the rest. Do you really have to do that? Tim owned a house in San Jose, but was moved to San Francisco. Unfortunately, the value of his property plummeted, and he would have lost $150,000 on a sale. So, he decided to rent it out, despite not wanting to deal with the headaches. After enough tenant caused stress, Tim asked himself, does he really need to do this? Everyone around him said it had to be done. He can mitigate losses by having a tenant, and now would be a poor time to sell, but by this point, Tim was already doing well financially. He didn't need the money, and he didn't want the headaches. So, even though he was losing less money having a tenant, he ultimately decided to keep it vacant. So, just because something makes financial sense and everyone tells you you must do it, do you really have to do it? Are you feeding on mice or hunting antelope? Imagine you are a lion and more than capable of squashing little mice. Would you? Do you often see lions hunting tiny prey, or do you see them hunting nice big chunks of meat? If you want to be a lion in your life, whether that be business, competition, or other, you want to focus on the big game prize. Don't waste your time chasing around mice. Go after the antelope. It should be noted this analogy doesn't work quite as well for blue whales, which are the largest animals in history and feed on krill. But who wants to be a blue whale anyway? How can money fix this? While this question may not be immediately applicable if you don't have much money, once you get it, you should start asking yourself how you can solve problems with money. When you are starting out and don't have much money, you spend time, and a lot of it. You work all day, every day, and you earn money. However, once you have achieved some success, your time will become significantly more important. So, the more you earn, the more you should look to spend to buy back time. This may start off simple enough, like hiring a maid, but over time may develop into hiring a chef to prepare meals for you, or to have a full-time personal assistant to help with lower priority but necessary tasks. You also want to look to outsource as much of your work as possible. If you have a job which has 10 types of tasks you need to perform on a regular basis, but only 2 of those require a significant amount of skill, hire an assistant to do the other 8 tasks for you. Summing it up, learn the rules like a pro, so you can break them like an artist. Pablo Picasso. Tim would use the sauna most nights for about 25 minutes to de-stress. A few times a day he would practice archery to take a break from writing. Tim kept his cool more so than during the writing of his other books, particularly when close to deadline. One friend commented on how calm he was. What had changed? What was different? It took Tim a moment to reflect on why his emotional state had improved relative to previous writing deadlines. He realized he had learned much more from those interviews than he thought he did. Not only did he learn information, but he started implementing some of these tactics almost unconsciously. He wasn't trying to implement them. He was trying to finish his book, yet things were different this time. It was this moment that Tim understood the power of the information which was bestowed upon him. So, the next time you feel anxious or depressed or want to give up, remember, you have this book, and you can come back to it as often as you'd like. You have the information, you have the power, and you have the tools of titans.
Beast Mode Motivation Strikes Back Motivational Audiobook Written and Narrated by Knight Rider.
Time! Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, it's time for your favorite motivator since you heard Shia LaBeouf say, "Just do it! Don't let your dreams be dreams." It's only been a couple months since I've been gone, but good gosh, is it great to be back. Now, I wasn't planning on making another Beast Mode so soon. Wrote a couple other books, but I've been listening. I've been getting your messages on Instagram saying, "Knight Rider, Knight Rider, please help. We need you back. We need you to continue on your quest to end the pussification of men across this great land." Well, Knight Rider, a.k.a. your boy King Beast, is back and better than ever. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the Beast Mode series, this is a place for you to be a man. This is a place where you think big, take actions that are even bigger, and apologize to no one for being a man and wanting it all. Here at Beast Mode, we do not settle for average. We do not settle for just enough money to get by. We do not settle for a job that we don't love. We, most importantly, we don't give up on our goals, ever. Our goals, our dreams, are all that we have when we don't have much. I know some of y'all are already living an amazing, high-quality life, but I also know that some of you have very little. You may not have your own place. Maybe you don't have your own car. You don't even have a job. Y'all may not even have a woman. I mean, that sucks. You may have no specialized skills, talents, or knowledge. You may have been brought up in a family which didn't have a lot. You might even be ugly. You might be fat. You might be a color or a sexual orientation or a gender that society tells you is bad or less than. You might have more debt than assets and literally be worth less than nothing, at least financially speaking. Having goals is important when you are doing well, but imperative when you are not doing well, because you already have so little. You need those goals. You need those dreams. See, when you're flying high at 40,000 feet in your private jet, you can coast for a while. You know, you can throttle down, lose a little bit of the momentum, lose a little bit of that altitude, but you're still doing pretty well when you throttle up at 30,000 feet, right? You still got quite a bit of inertia going. But when you're in the hole and you're fighting and pushing and clawing at maximum force, just clawing at the sides, trying to break even, trying to get back to the surface, you can't afford to give up. You don't have the luxury of relaxing, and there is no point in complaining about it. There's no point in whining, oh, well, that person was born into the right family and got a scholarship to college and hired at a better job, blah, blah, blah. Complaining is not going to change the reality of your situation. And if you've ever listened to a Beast Mode program before, you already know the only thing which will change your situation, and that's hard work. Complaining about an unfair or unjust reality will not change it. I'm not saying it's not there, okay? I'm not a sociopath incapable of empathy or compassion or understanding. To the contrary, I feel for you. I feel for your situation. I understand that things are unjust. But I don't want you wasting your life, your energy, the little energy that you have. Well, this beast mode, you know what I'm saying? We got a lot of energy here. We got high energy. But you can't even waste 1% of that on something that's not actually going to better your situation. That's where we need to focus. We want to focus 100% of our energy, our time, on something that will better our situation. I want you to get out of a bad situation if you're in it. I want you to live a better, higher quality life. I want you to be a beast. And beasts do not have pity parties for themselves. Beasts don't focus and complain about their own misfortunes, which they cannot change. A beast will work and work and work until he claws his way out of that hole. I want you to realize something right now. Any adversity you are going through now, all that bad stuff which has happened to you in your past will do one of two things. Either it will break you and you will give up and continue to live out the rest of your life in mediocrity. Or you will continue to fight and you will claw your way out of that hole and become stronger. And by the way, the deeper the hole, the stronger you will be when you rise from it. And when enough time goes by and you're flying in the sky next to the people who have had it easy all their life, they won't even have a chance. You will destroy them. You will dominate their space. They won't even have a chance of competing with you. They're soft. They don't have the drive, the determination, the willpower. They haven't gone through what you went through. They didn't have to work like you had to work to get to where you're gonna go or to where you are now. So do not feel sorry for yourself. Be thankful that you were given adversity to make you stronger. Now, some of you may disagree with my logic, or say, well, Knight Rider, what if I am one of those lucky few who were born with more than my fair share? Then you make that an advantage. Right now, I am not dealing in reality. I am merely dealing in the reality of an individual's mind. The purpose you attach to your situation is what will influence how you act. You cannot control what has happened to you. You cannot control your genetics, what family you were born into. But you can control the meaning you give to those events. There are advantages and disadvantages to every individual situation. No one has it perfect. You must find the advantages to your situation, no matter whatever it is, and highlight those in your own mind. And if somebody else has the opposite situation, they need to do the same thing. They need to look at your situation. Oh, that's bad. I don't want that. But then they look at their own situation and say, yeah, that's the ideal situation. Whatever your situation is, you must focus on it and say why that is the ideal situation. It's not what happens to us. It is how we interpret what happens to us. You must focus on where you want to go and how your current situation will help you get there. Now listen, not everyone's life is horrible. Even those who have horrible things happen to them will periodically get a break, right? They'll have moments that are lucky. But you know what happens when most people get a break? They have one of those lucky moments. They don't take advantage of it. And then maybe they'll go back to their unlucky life. They might have one or two moments, but if they don't take advantage of them, they're going, oh, I'm so unlucky. I never had any chances. I never had a break. Maybe they did, but maybe they didn't take advantage of it. They sabotage themselves. You know why people sabotage themselves? Because they don't know if they deserve it. Or they're pretty sure they don't deserve it. Now, I'm not saying that they'll come right out and tell you, I don't deserve it. To the contrary, most people be like, I do deserve it. But that's not how your unconscious mind works. Most likely, they have no conscious clue as to what is guiding their actions. But it is in human nature to not feel worthy of things which are simply handed to us, especially when we have lived our whole lives without it. Now, if you were born into a great situation, that's a little bit different. You've lived your whole life being used to just being handed things. But if you've lived your whole life being broke, that is what your unconscious mind adjusts to. It's used to that. That's what your unconscious mind knows and where it feels comfortable. That is what it believes it's worth. Why do you think 71% of lottery winners go bankrupt? That's not even including the ones who burn through the large majority of their winnings with only a small amount left. 71% literally go bankrupt. That means they literally ended up with less than nothing. They had something to begin with, right? They lived their whole life, right? They lived their whole 55 years on this earth perfectly fine off of minimum wage and didn't go bankrupt, and then they win $55 million, and then they have less than zero. Your unconscious mind has a thermostat. It will tell you what you deserve and what you do not deserve. And if you are just given something or work half-ass for it, your unconscious mind will tell you, hey, man, I don't think you earned this. I don't think you deserve this. You're not, you know, you didn't really work for this. And as a consequence, the mind will sabotage itself. The only way to overcome this is to work harder than what it is that you gain. You must always work harder than what you receive. If you are the hardest working person in your business, Of course you will have the highest income. And of course you'll be looked at first for promotions and get opportunities that other workers won't. If you exercise every single day and your diet is on point every single day, of course you're going to have a better body than everyone else. If you start your own business and you take that risk and you make the phone calls and you make the products and you set up the distribution and you produce kick-ass advertising and you're working 12-hour plus days, of course your house is going to be bigger than your buddy's house from high school. Of course your car is going to be nicer than all your friends and family's car. Of course your girlfriend's going to be better looking. Well, I don't know about that one. But listen, the point is your brain knows that when you work harder, you're going to get more back. That makes sense to the mind. What doesn't make sense is when you've lived your whole life one way, and then all of a sudden, you're just given an opportunity. You're just given something. It doesn't make sense. It seems unfair. So think of it this way. If you ever start to feel like you don't deserve what you have, or you don't deserve an opportunity which has come your way, be happy. Because that is a sign that you are capable of more. That is your unconscious mind saying, hey, you know, you're only working at like 2/3 steam here. You don't really deserve this. I mean, you're not working at full capacity. So take that as a sign that you need to work harder. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing when you can do more. If you're working at 100% and you still don't have what you want, I mean, that's not a good sign. But if you have opportunities coming your way and you're not even putting in 100%, that's a good thing. That means if you actually do apply yourself and you do start going to 100%, watch out, world. See, most people, they'll get that sign, but they'll just give up. You know, their brain will tell them, oh, dude, I don't know. You're not really giving this 100%. I don't know if you deserve this. And they'll just give up. They'll just take their foot off the throttle, kind of see what happens, right? We're just going to coast for a little bit. And then what happens? We all know you lose the opportunity. When you get that sign, you need to push forward and work harder and tell your unconscious mind to stick that negativity where the sun don't shine, because you are going to be working like a beast and you deserve everything that's coming your way and more and more. The harder you work, the more greedy you can get. If you work like a sheep, however, when you're trying to take your girl out to dinner, it's going to be like, we can go to Denny's, yeah, or we can go to IHOP. Like, oh, babe, it's like, you spoil me too much. Listen, if you work like a beast, you'll be picking between owning an island in the Bahamas or an island in Dubai. You know, like one of those like country island things in that like world island thing. You know what I'm talking about. That's pretty cool. If you put in genuine work, your mind will set you free. It's not going to limit you. It's going to be like, yeah, Knight, you deserve it. Go get it. Go get it, Knight Rider. But if you half-ass it, it will sabotage you. And you'll never fulfill your dreams. You're never going to be great. How do you expect to be the best in the world? How do you expect to shake the world to really accomplish something that will be remembered for hundreds of years if you don't put in 100%? And listen, I know some people don't believe this whole self-sabotaging thing. That's cool. So look, all I say is if you have any doubt that your unconscious mind can self-sabotage, test it. The next time you're feeling like you don't deserve greatness, write down how you feel on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being best. Then put in an honest full days of work. Okay. And by the way, 8 hours, not a full day of work. Okay. I'm talking like a genuine full day. You wake up and you start working. Okay, so maybe wait till your day off if you have a 9-to-5, okay? Wait until you have a day off, get all your other crap done, put in a full day's work, you wake up and you get your ass to work until you have to go to bed. A full day's work towards your dreams. And then, at the end of the day, just jot down again how you feel on a scale of 1 to 10. See if there's any improvement. See if you feel like you deserve that after a couple days. You know, do that for a couple days in a row, or once again, if you work a 9-to-5, just after hours or before, whatever it is, take all your remaining hours and put in, like, for a solid week, put in as much time as you possibly can, and then write that 1 to 10. How do you feel, right? 10 being best. Do you feel like you deserve it more? Or do you still feel like, oh, I don't deserve this? Just see if there's any change in a day or a week. Then hit me up on Instagram, at One Night Rider. Let me know if you noticed any difference in terms of what you felt like you were capable of achieving and if you deserve that. But what do you do when you hit a bad snag? Right? So I'm not talking about, oh, I don't deserve it, or I deserve this, or this is unfair, but like, you're going at it, right? You're going at it, and you just kind of, just hit a little snag. What do you do when your motivation runs out? Like, oh yeah, I listened to Beast Mode, totally motivated, and then, you know, like, a couple weeks goes by, and you're like, hey, maybe a couple days, right? You're like, I don't know. Motivation's gone, right? Your Hulk, your Beast Mode, your Hulk starts turning back into, like, Bruce Banner. I mean, come on, let's be honest. Everyone's like, yeah, Hulk smash. No one's like, oh, Bruce Banner, he's my favorite Avenger, he's super cool. Mentally, I want you to be a beast, dude. I want you to be Hulk. Beast desires. And I want you to be in beast mode as often as possible. But in order to operate at that extreme level of energy and production, we need to be intelligent and analyze our human limitations, okay? So I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking about your desires. I'm talking about, dude, we're human, right? So no matter how much of a beast you are, we're all human, okay? Whether a human, an animal, a computer, a car, any machine, you cannot run it at 100% maximum output forever. It's gonna break down, and it's gonna break down a lot quicker if you just permanently leave it on maximum output. Think about sprinting, okay, like running. Think about sprinting at maximum output as fast as you possibly can. An elite sprinter, right? So someone who runs for a living, like that's their entire life's purpose, is to run, can only run for about 20 seconds at maximum output. And these are people who run for a living. That's their whole life's purpose, is running 20 seconds. Okay, I mean, I'm not saying exactly 20, but, you know, give or take, like, you know, 2 seconds, whatever it is. Every person's a little bit different. But on average, it's right about 20 seconds of maximum output, and it decreases after that. All right, that equates to about 200 meters. So 200 meters or anything less than that, a sprinter can run at 100% maximum output. But once we move to the 400 meter, instead of a sprinter coming in around 40 seconds, which would be along those lines of 100% maximum performance, it's actually closer to around 44 seconds, equating to approximately a 10% reduction in performance, even though the body has only been performing for less than a minute. Moving to the 800 meter, instead of a sprinter coming in around 80 seconds, which would be that maximum performance, it's actually closer to around 101 seconds, equating to a bit over a 25% reduction in performance in just over a minute. As the length continues to increase, the average performance slash output at any given moment decreases. Think of it this way. During a 200 meter sprint, or anything shorter than that distance, there is no point in the race at which it is possible for the competitor to run faster. He is literally running at his personal, at that time, maximum output during the entire duration of that race. Now, let's contrast this to a marathon, potentially excluding the very, very end. Is there any single point in the race at which the competitor is performing at that 100% maximum output? No, because that is not the proper strategy for that race. If you were to go to the competitor, I mean any competitor, at mile 3, 9, or 15, anywhere in there, and say, hey, could you run the next 20 meters faster if you wanted to? Of course the answer would be yes, but they also know that would cause negative consequences down the line, so they have to pace themselves. And pacing yourself is not something which comes natural to us. It's something we need to learn both physically and mentally. Think about going on a jog with a young child. The child has no concept of pacing himself, whether that be mentally or physically. Whether you tell the kid you're going for a short, little quick jog or a super, you're jogging across the entire world, what's the kid gonna do? He has no concept of length of time. Every single kid does the exact same thing. They bolt off at full throttle for about 30 yards and then they literally stop. And the now out of breath kid will be like, are we done now? I'm like, no, you stupid little kid. We're just getting started. Your job is to teach that kid to pace himself. And they tend to be very quick learners, and I would certainly recommend going out for a jog with your kids or other kids, right? You have to teach them the right habits, but that's a different subject. But this concept of a continually decreasing maximum load applies to virtually everything the physical body does. For example, think of this in weightlifting terms. You have a 1 rep max. That is considered to be your maximum output for that particular movement. And then as you decrease the output, i.e. lowering the weight, you can perform more reps, i.e. sustain the action for a longer period of time. Now, here's where things start to get interesting and why we're talking about this in the first place. All right, I just kind of use the whole physical thing as an example to get to the mental part. The same concept of increasing and decreasing your output, which equates to how long you can do that thing for, that also applies to the human brain and its ability to focus. Now, if you speak to productivity experts, most of them will tell you the average person can exert maximum focus for somewhere between around 20 to 45 minutes, depending upon which expert you're talking to. So, I ask you this. How long do you think you can exert maximum mental focus before you start to see a decline in output? I'll give you a second here. I actually want you to think of a number. Do you think this falls, in that 20-minute range, in the 45-minute range, less than that, more than that? What do you think your number is? Okay, do you have it? How about 3 minutes? Have you ever visited a science museum, science center, or something similar, and you have one of those reaction time machines? Okay, I mean, you can actually, now you can just go on like a website, just like Google, kind of time reaction test, and you can just do it on your computer, okay? But if you know what I'm talking about, it's just one of those things where typically it kind of involves like a ruler type object, and it'll have little notations on it which denotes time, and it'll fall at a random time, and as soon as it falls, you need to hit a button, and that will catch the ruler, and it'll stop it, and then you'll look at the little notations, and that will tell you what your reaction time is. Now, the actual reaction time is irrelevant, kind of what your personal maximum reaction time is. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is how long it takes until you begin to see a slower reaction time relative to what your maximum is. All your body is doing is pushing a button. So the slower reaction time is caused by mental fatigue, nothing to do with your body fatiguing. It was found that after a mere 3 minutes, reaction time began to slow and continued to slow for the duration of the 10-minute test. In addition to this, preemptive mistakes where the person would hit the button before the object actually dropped also significantly increased after that 3-minute mark. Unlike most of the work we do, this is a constant and heightened state of stress. It's a constant tension. right? You're always waiting for that ruler to drop, or, you know, if you're doing it on your computer, like the screen to turn green or red or whatever it is, it's a constant, never-ending state of stress, and that's not something your brain, your brain doesn't really work like that on a regular basis. So that's a little bit closer to kind of like that maximum output because it's a constant stress. The brain does not need a large amount of time to recover, right? It can recover pretty quickly, but it does need time to recover. So when you have that constant stress on it, it really, you know, brings down that amount of time that you can focus. This was even shown in the experiment, how you just need a little bit of time to kind of recover, and people would kind of do this self-regulating thing where they would kind of go on swings where the average reaction time would slow by about only 5/100ths of a second, but that was enough for them to slightly turn off, relax their brain, and they would do this for a duration of about 20 to 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden, their reactions would get quicker by about 5/100ths of a second. And then they do this for, you know, another 30 to 60 seconds or so, and then there would be another drop-off period for about 20 to 30 seconds where the reaction time would slow, and it would continue. It would kind of bounce in this waveform. I mean, slowly it was decreasing, you know, the overall reaction times were decreasing with time, but this waveform was still kind of constant throughout the test. And that was people trying to give their brain, they could not focus 100% all of the time, even though it was just a couple minutes, right? They had to give their brain a little bit of a break, and 5/100ths of a second was enough to do that, even for just as small as 20 seconds, but they did have to give their brain that break. Now, the reason I told you that is so you can understand how the brain works, in that there are periods of time where it works most efficient, and then it's going to pull back for a little bit, and then it's going to continue to go at that high output. Okay. Now, when it comes to highly focused work that we actually come across in real life, right, like sports training or studying, reading complex kind of like technical material, obviously that's going to be more than 3 minutes. All right. So it's a longer period of focus, but the concept of needing a break still applies. You want to focus very, very hard for however long you need to do it. But then you want to put little breaks in there. So if you have 10 hours of work you need to do, probably not a good idea to work 10 hours straight with literally zero break. It's not an intelligent way to do things. Your overall performance is going to suffer. Your brain simply cannot work at 100% maximum output for 10 hours straight. Or even if you're just doing something for 2 hours, right? You want to have little itty bitty moments where your brain can relax a little bit, recover, and then go back to maximum output for the relative thing that you're doing. Now, let's say you're going through your normal work day, maybe it's a 12-hour day, and you want to chunk this, say, 50 minutes on and a 10-minute break. Or you can, you know, if you're like, I want to do, you know, more than that, okay, 55 minutes on, 5-minute break, 45 minutes on, 15-minute break, or you can do, I mean, you can structure it any way you want to structure it. The point is taking a break, a period where your mind can recuperate, is a very intelligent and natural way for the brain to work. Now, most of us somewhat understand this concept when it comes to work sessions, but may not be quite as highly conscious of it in terms of longer than a single day, right? We might go, oh, well, I understand that I need a break. I can't work, you know, 12 hours straight. I need to take a lunch or have little breaks. I kind of get that. But this exact same concept applies over a multiple day period in terms of weeks or months. Okay, so think about it. How many days or weeks or months, whatever it is for you, can you maintain on and going, I mean, let's not, maybe not say absolute 100% maximum efficiency. We don't need to be 100% every day, but where you can be operating at like 80%+. You're still, I mean, you're getting a lot of stuff done. Because we're talking 100% of absolute max, where you wake up, you work all day long, and you go to bed, right? So if you can maintain 80% of that, I mean, you're doing really well. So how long, how many days or weeks or whatever it is, do you think you can maintain that 80%, maybe we'll call that 12 hours a day? Do you think you can work 12 hours a day? And I mean, these are hard hours, okay, where you're really genuinely working. You're not screwing around on your phone. You're not watching movies. You're not hanging out with your girlfriend. I mean, you're working 12 hours hard work every single day, day in and day out. How many days do you think you can do that before you're going to need an amount of time off? Okay, so whether that be a day or multiple days, how many days do you think you can work before you're going to need a day off? This is somewhat regulated when you work for other people, right? Because a typical person may work an 8-hour day, and they're going to have like a lunch in there, and they work 5 days a week with 2 days off. That's a normal standard full-time job, at least in the United States. As jobs get more important and they also pay more money, your work is likely going to increase. Maybe instead of 5, you're working 6 days a week. And instead of working 40 hours, maybe you're working 60, 70 hours a week. That's generally kind of on the higher end of normal jobs where you're working for other people. Of course, there are exceptions and there are people who are working super, super crazy hours just working for other people. But as a generalization, that's the high end, you know, maybe 6 days a week, 70 hours. But when you're self-employed, there's absolutely zero limit and there's no regulation. There's nobody telling you how many hours to work, how many days to work. There's nobody telling you when to take days off or not take days off. You can do whatever you want when you run your own life. This can be a bit more tricky to manage. People who are self-employed or run their own business, or maybe they're like on a 1099 living on a commission, so they don't have kind of like an hour restriction or like a day restriction. This type of individual, right, this kind of demographic tends to be a lot more motivated and thus end up working a lot more hours. Now, the sheep will tell you, like, oh, dude, you're working too much. You're going to burn out, man. The sheep will tell you that you should at absolute bare minimum take at least 1 day a week off. Okay, let's define that a little bit more clearly. What is that? That's 1 day every 7 days. That's what the sheep will tell you. Take at least 1 day every 7 days off. If you want to be a little bit of a jerk, maybe have a little bit of fun next time someone tells you that, ask them, how did you come to that number? How did you come to that conclusion? 1 day a week. How did you come to that thought process? You know, what was the thought process behind that? And the sheep will often, you know, maybe be a little confused and they'll say something kind of like, well, you know, maybe because you should take time off. So, you know, you should take at least 1 day a week off. Because if you don't, then you'll never take a day off. Right? So to the sheep who is incapable of thinking for him or herself, that they don't understand the concept that you work for yourself. Just because you work 7 days 1 week doesn't mean that you can take a day off next week or the week after. You have control over your schedule. The sheep also does not understand that since you work for yourself, you are not bound by a 7 day week. Why is it that the sheep is so fascinated with the concept of a week, with this 7 day structure that you must conform your life to? Do you even know why there are 7 days in a week? Okay, think about this. A day has a value from an astronomical standpoint, obviously. A year has a very easy to understand astronomical value, right? Going around the sun. A month has an astronomical value, which relates to the moon going around the earth. But what about a week? Does something about 7 days have an astronomical value? The only reason there are 7 days in a week, and if you really think about it, that's kind of stupid because like 7 doesn't even go into 30 or 31, right? Why 7? Wouldn't 6 make more sense, right? Because 6 is at least divisible by 30. 7, it's illogical. Why 7? The only reason that there's 7 is because 2,600 years ago, when the ancient Babylonians were creating the calendar, they were only aware of 7 astronomical bodies: the Sun, the Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. They didn't know Neptune and Uranus and Pluto. Well, Pluto's not a planet anymore, but deal with people. Pluto's not a planet. Each of the days of the week were named after these seven heavenly bodies. Right, that's right. Like, it didn't matter if it was the moon, the sun, a planet. To them, it was all the same thing. That's all that they knew existed. These seven heavenly bodies. Now, of course, language has changed quite a bit since 600 BC. But just a little fun fact: two of the 7 days are still have a direct translation to that. Okay, and that of the sun for Sunday and Saturn for Saturday. As a side note, a millennium later, when Christians took over Rome, and they had to squash the concept of polytheism, right, because they're like, y'all are going to be Christians, deal with it. As each of the seven known heavenly bodies, aka days, were named after different gods, they had to change what a week meant. But they were too lazy to change the whole damn calendar, and let's be honest, calendars are like kinda complex, so they just changed the story to say that God created the heavens and earth and rested in 7 days. So, if you ever wondered, why does it say God took 7 days and not 6 days, not 8 days, like why is it 7 days? Now you know. That's why he created the universe in 7 days. Also interesting to note, if today we were creating the calendar, there would be 195 days in a week, as that's the current number of known planets, dwarf planets, and moons, and plus the sun. And by the time that you listen to this, there's probably even going to be more. So why is this relevant? It is relevant because 99% of people plan their life around this arbitrary number, the week, which means nothing. How many hours are they going to work in a week? How many days are they going to take off in a week? How many times are they going to go to the gym in a week? And so on and so on. Their entire life is around a week. I told you the history of the week so you understand that it literally has absolutely nothing to do with you and what you are capable of as a human being. It doesn't mean that you have to take one day off every 7 days. It doesn't mean that your brain is incapable of maintaining focus for more than 6 days in a row. Now, I'm just trying to get my point across from a theoretical standpoint where you would have complete control over your schedule. Okay. Now, you may be working for someone else, or you hold regular hours, or you're going to school, or you have some sort of regular obligation, and you have to a degree, work within the weekly structure. Most of us do to a degree. But I want you to understand the principle of what I'm talking about. So, imagine that you are a professional poker player. You can play as many or as few hours as you want. You can play as many or as few days as you want in a row. Now, of course, in reality, there are peak times in the day and peak days of the week, you know, when the games are softest, but let me get my point across, okay? Just ignore that for now. How should you structure your work schedule? Well, I'm sorry to tell you, there is no right or wrong answer to this. This is just one of those things where you need to figure out what works best for you. There are two primary trains of thought. The first being almost identical to the structure of working for someone else, except it tends to have more hours because, you know, we're beasts, right? Like, we in boss mode, we in beast mode. So we can't just do this little 40-hour junk, right? It's more hours, more days, so maybe you'll be doing 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, something like that. But there are stop times, there are break times, there are start times, there are lunch times, there's days off, there are planned vacations, all this stuff, okay, that will be firmly put in place so you have a rigid structure to work within. There are many ultra successful people who use this strategy, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with it. The only thing you want to keep in mind is that you should try your best to completely forget that 5 day per week, 40 hour standard. That standard is merely a result of the minimum amount of work required by the typical average individual, right, the masses, what they need to do in today's society to maintain a base standard of living, not a good standard of living, right? Not where we want to be going. We're beast mode, right? We want it big. We want it great. But to maintain like that, okay, you have a roof over your head. You have, you know, some food. You have clothes. You have a semi-working car, right? Kind of like a base standard of living. That's where that 40 hours, 5 days thing is at this moment. But it has absolutely zero reflection on what you personally are capable of. So you need to figure that out for yourself. So instead of working 5 days out of 7 days, you may be capable of doing 6 days out of 8 days, or 7 days out of 9 days. As modern society advances, each individual needs to do less and less in order to maintain that base standard of living, which we don't want, but the masses will suffice for. Therefore, the average work week has steadily decreased over time. The average work week in the 1830s, which was around the time that kind of modern tracking of this started, was 69 hours a week. That was the average, right? Could you imagine that today? Everybody works 69 hours a week. And your friends are complaining because they have to work 40. Or, I mean, heaven forbid you work in a restaurant and they complain about working like 30 hours a week? Come on! All right. In the 1830s, it was 69 hours a week because we didn't have the society set up at that point, right? We didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have things built. We didn't have the technology. So you had to work more to have that base standard of living. All right. 40 years later, in the 1870s, it went from 69 hours to 62 hours. It's a pretty big jump. I mean, even back in the 1870s, that's already 7 hours less per week. In the 1910s, I don't know if that's, is that how you say it, the 1910s? I never got that, right? They're like, oh, it's 2010s, right? Because you got the 20s and 30s, but what do you call the 10s? I don't know. If anyone knows, hit me up on Instagram, let me know. I never know what to call like the 10s, so the 1910s, it came down from 62 hours to 53 hours. In the 1940s, it was 45 hours. In the 1980s, it was 39 hours, and in the 2010s, I still, I'm like, is that how you say it? The 2010s? I never know. This is the first time I've had to say it in audiobooks. I'm like, the 2010s? I don't know, is what you say? The 10s? In the early 2010s, it's been 34 hours. So actually, in modern society, you know, so many people are working part-time and still getting by. It's under 40 hours a week. You don't even need to work 40 hours a week to have that base standard of living. But then again, we know those types of people. We know the type of life they have, and we know that that's not what we want. So as you can see, average work weeks, you know, they're constantly changing. They're constantly going down. Of course, in times of stress, you know, and economic, contraction, average, you know, work weeks will go up, but overall, over time, they are going down. And these changes have absolutely nothing to do with what humans are capable of. It's just the minimum that needs to get done. And obviously, as time goes on, we have more and more houses already built, and we have more roads already built, and infrastructure already put in place. We just need to do less and less. And technology and machines, everything's there. So we need to do less, but that doesn't mean that you should do less. They are the sheep. They'll work their little 40 hours, or in this case, 34 hours, right? Whatever it is. They'll work their little things, and they'll live in their crappy 60-year-old house, and they'll drive their crappy 12-year-old car that breaks down all the time and has 150,000 miles, and they'll be living paycheck to paycheck. And they'll be giving you advice saying how you should live your life. And they'll also simultaneously be talking about how you can never get ahead in this life and everything's rigged. White man's going to take it away. Oh, the big brother's going to take it away. Whatever it is, right? Government's going to take it away. Everything's horrible. Of course, you're working 34 hours a week. What do you think you're going to get out of life? You're working 40 hours a week. What do you think? You're working 45 hours a week. That's nothing. Come on, go back to the 1830s. You're not even going to be able to survive in the 1830s. Want a life lesson? I'm not going to give it to you, but sure as hell, do not take life lessons from losers. Do not take life lessons from the sheep of this world and from people who do not have the success that you want. So, that's the first strategy, right? The first strategy for those who are self-employed is to construct a relatively rigid structure for them to work in, but one that tends to include a lot more work days and a lot more work hours than the average person. Our hypothetical poker player may decide he wants to work, say, 8 days in a row and then take 1 day off, and then he'll work 7 days in a row and then he'll take 2 days off. Right? Whatever he wants to do, doesn't matter. Okay? It can be a normal, oh, six on, one off, or it can be odd and lopsided, doesn't matter. Okay? Whatever he wants to schedule for himself, and then he will stick to that schedule. The second strategy is much less rigid. Essentially, it is listening to your body and adjusting on the fly. Let's go back to the sprinter example. Do sprinters run their personal best record every single time? Of course not. They hardly ever do it. Their times are going to change every single time they run that race. Every single day, they're going to be a little bit faster, a little bit slower. All right, some days are going to be better than others, but what changes? Well, their body changes, their mind changes, their diet leading up to that run may not have been quite as optimal, or maybe it was better than it was before. Their sleep might not have been might as deep, or maybe it was better, and that's leading to a worse or better performance. Alright, maybe he had insomnia the previous night. Maybe he got in a fight with his girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. Maybe he was under a lot more stress. The human body and mind are so fragile that they can change from day to day from just these little things. Like, oh, I got some McDonald's instead of having a salad. Right? Oh, I got in a little fight with my girlfriend. Oh, you know, I stayed up late and smoked weed and played video games. I don't know why I'm not running as fast. Therefore, some days, the sprinter can run faster than other days. The same applies to you and your work. Let's say that Joe Blow has been working semi-efficiently the past several months trying to put together a business. Joe eats McDonald's every day, all day long, 3 times a day, and does not exercise. How many days can Joe work and be highly productive? So none of this half-ass stuff. How many days can he work? Say, all right, right now, Joe, starting right now, you're going to work 100%. How many days can he do that before he needs a day off? Now, of course, it's impossible to know, but probably not that many. Let's just pick a number. Let's say he can do 5 days and then he's burnt out, right? He needs a day off. Now let's look at Joe Blow in a parallel universe. This Joe just got back from an extended vacation, right? Took a couple weeks with the girls, went on like a cruise or something, just chilling. Well, maybe not a cruise because then you got that like dry sickness land sickness thing when you get back. So, okay. You like, whatever. He went on a vacation. You get the point. I'm thinking I went on a cruise a couple months ago. I'm like, yeah, I know that. I was not very productive when I got back from my cruise for a couple days. Like, really bad headache. Anyways, look. So he went on vacation. He's chill. He's completely relaxed. He's exercising every single day, right? And he's doing like cardiovascular stuff, right? Really good for the heart, getting all that stress out. He's maintaining a healthy diet, a lot of grains, fruits, vegetables, clean sources of protein. All right, how many days can Joe work and be highly productive before he needs a day off? Once again, impossible to know, but I'd be willing to bet that he can work more days than in the previous example. So if it was 5 days before, I'm going to bet he can probably do, you know, 7, 8, 9, somewhere around there. Now, let's continue with this second example where he's being healthier. He takes 1 day off after however many days, okay? So let's just say, like, he worked for 8 days, and he takes 1 day off, and then he gets back to work, still eating well and exercising, All right, still maintaining that healthy lifestyle. Now, how many days can he work? 8? Maybe not, right? Because before he went on that long vacation, he was totally good. So, I mean, he can do the 8, but maybe this time, maybe he can do 7 days. And then he needs a day off. The point is, in all of these examples, we are talking about the exact same person, but his personal capabilities are changing based upon all of the other factors in his life. This is the benefit of working with a non-fixed schedule. If your productivity begins to suffer at a significant level, you can take time off earlier than you otherwise would to recuperate. Similarly, if your diet and exercise and life in general are all on point, they're all doing well, and it's keeping your stress levels down, you can extend the hours you work, whether that be for a session within a day or a day,